proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So unemployment, historic low. If you read Donald Trump's Twitter feed, you would think it was the economy was just smoking for everyone. And it is smoking for some, those especially at the top, thanks to our huge, enormous tax cut that we gave them. And this is one of those things that just blows my mind. And I'm going to ask my next guest about this. Because, you know, you do tax cuts to stimulate the economy. If the economy were really as red hot as it was, why did you need to stimulate it? Just kind of a thought. Also want to talk a little bit about the gig economy and how are our gig friends doing. That's why I've asked Carla Walter to come talk with us. She's the Director of Employment Policy there at the Center for American Progress. Carla, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me jump right into that first question. You know, if the economy were doing all this this great, and it was, you know, the best ever, and you know, it's as it's been since day one of the Trump administration, why did we need to stimulate it?
That's a good question. I think that what we see is that the stimulation was all wrong, too. I think that the way we would have seen wages rise in this current economy would be by giving workers more power, not corporations more tax breaks.
Yeah, but we were all going to get $4,000. In fact, I go to the mailbox every day looking for my Trump prize.
Yeah. I think there's only one person who got that prize.
he got all of ours. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. No, I mean, seriously, though, I think that the problem what we saw is we used to see wages go up when we had a hot economy, and it made sense, right? Everybody would get a share of the wealth that our country was creating at the time. Now, even though our economy is getting more and more productive, workers aren't getting rewarded for that. There's lots and lots of ways that there have been attacks on the power of workers to bargain in our economy.
Yep.
You know very well that union power has been attacked for 20 years, and it's starting to affect the amount of power that workers have in the economy. But even small things where we talk about fast food workers who are getting forced to sign, they're making $7.25 an hour and getting forced to sign non-compete agreements so they can't go down the road and get a job as a manager. Well, you can't bargain for higher wages at your current employer, and you can't get higher wages down the road if you're signing those non-competes. So I think that there's a multitude of ways that employers, low-road employers, are chipping away at the power of workers.
How insane is that? I mean, you really stop and, you know, let that sink in for a second, that you've made a sandwich for one company, and by making that sandwich, you're now incapable of going anywhere else and making a sandwich somewhere else. I mean, that's really, really taking this a bit too far, don't you think?
Oh, and you can take it even a step further. I've talked to lawyers who represent workers in these cases, and they say that, you know, the quintessential case that you're talking about is Jimmy John's. They say that Jimmy John's workers were going to win his case. That wasn't in question. This isn't the purpose of a non-compete law. But employers put it in those contracts because the worst that happens is it's unenforceable. It's
right.
Not illegal to put it in an employment contract. It's just unenforceable.
Right, but it's the chilling effect.
It's the chilling effect. And so workers get tricked. And, you know, you don't not everyone can be a labor lawyer. Yet, in many ways, it feels like you have to be a labor lawyer, a retirement expert, know all your workforce protections, know all the ways to be an expert investor in order to get ahead in today's economy for too many workers.
Yeah, I mean, this is the you're on your own, brother economy. And everybody out there is trying to screw you out of whatever it is that they can get out of you, which, again, you can go down the list of all the things that the conservative ideology has brought us. And it's, in my view, all bad. I mean, I'm still struggling to find something positive out of the you're on your own economy.
Yeah, and I think that at times it's not conservative. Chipping away at the protections we've got is not conservative ideology. That's a kill government, anti progressive, but also anti Republican ideology.
But don't you think, I mean, I 20 years ago, I may have agreed with you on that, but the current Republican, no, I mean, seriously, the current Republican Party, those who say we want to drag government into the bathtub so we want it small enough so we can drown it and shove it down the drain, they have dominated the current Republican Party. And I've taken to, I used to be much more forgiving of conservatives, saying, I have some conservative values as well and all that. But currently, anyone who calls themselves and tells you to their face that they're a conservative, it's generally the smaller government argument, you know, the small government, lower taxes, and the people who are pushing this kind of anti-worker ideology. So I'm no longer giving them a pass.
I know, and I don't think anybody should give them a pass. And I think that it's interesting to see that they aren't, that conservatives and anti-worker corporate lobby isn't getting a pass anymore. And it's not even getting a pass in places like West Virginia, and, you know, where we're seeing teachers go on strike and assert their rights, even though they haven't been recognized by the state haven't ever been recognized by the state.
Yeah. Well, here I've been saying, you know, once the Janus decision comes down and it goes the way I think everybody thinks it's going, except the one lawyer who she's extremely just that flowery, happy person that, you know, annoys everybody else. Outside of her, everybody else thinks it's going to go the wrong way. And it's my view that that's the end of industrial peace. That's the end of the New Deal era industrial peace. And we need to have more of these kind of strikes and more of these actions and more of shutting things down until our political class realizes that industrial peace is a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that is going to potentially be one result. But what we see is that Janus is, well, it's a Supreme Court decision. There is state laws who protect the rights of public sector workers to bargain. So there, I'm optimistic in that in some states there is a lot that states can do to, despite the a probable poor outcome in Janus, to support the workers' rights.
Yeah, I think the one that New Jersey just passed is a good start.
It's a good start, and there's a lot more that could be done.
Yeah, I'm with you, but I want to get to this other part of this because I read this Bureau of Labor Statistics report that was sent to me, and I just have to I love the language. It was a report on the contingent worker supplement, the CWS, to the Census Bureau's current population survey, and I guess contingent workers are what we affectionately call gig workers. Is that what it is?
They're gig workers. They're workers who are working for temporary agencies and on-call workers. They're your Uber driver, or they're independent contractors who are doing all sorts of things in our economy. I would say that this survey itself measured a small portion of what I would call broadly the gig workforce, because I include domestic workers. I include lots of workers who are simply aren't protected by the protections that we've long established in our country to make sure that work pays, is safe, you can save for retirement, that you get health care benefits. They're not covered under that rubric of laws. And I think that the survey came out today finding that there were approximately 14 million gig workers, which is a considerable amount, or contingent workers in our economy, which is a considerable amount of people who don't have those same protections that most of us enjoy.
No, that's a huge number. In fact, you know, that's right around the number of union members in the entire country. So you could maybe make the argument that a lot of those people who could be union members are now misclassified independent contractors, who, instead of being what we would have considered employees just 5 or 10 years ago, they're now, you're on your own, brother.
They're completely on their own. But going back to my state's comment, that's the interesting, exciting thing, is there's opportunities for states to allow those workers to unionize because they are classified as independent contractors. So right now we're at this moment where we have this growing, we have this economy that many people think are growing, some people say is not, but is sort of this quote-unquote new form of work. But as we're seeing rights erode for employees, there's something, states can look at these workers and either they can listen to some of the companies, corporate lobbies in this group, and carve them out for getting any future workplace protection, or they can think creatively about how do we protect these workers. And so there's really exciting things going on in Seattle, New York, Washington State to think about how do we protect these workers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the sad reality is our labor laws haven't really been updated in, 70 years? And you know, we've got the ossification of our labor law that's just, swung the pendulum way to the side of employers. And now they've come up with this other little scheme that, you know, I'll be honest with you, the future of work in this country is a scary place because, you know, in looking at this report, these gig workers who were all told they're going to be their own boss and they were going to make money, they're struggling to make it to the end of the week, let alone the end of the month.
There's a very interesting report that just came out from Economic Policy Institute that looked at Uber's own data and found that those workers, once you take out all their costs that they're having to pay for driver's insurance, for gasoline, for, you know, leasing a car and so on, they're making around $12 an hour.
Yeah.
Now, most people wouldn't sign up to own their own business if they thought that that's what they were making. And by the way, that's less than a lot of what the minimum wage is in a lot of urban markets where those workers are really, really concentrated.
Yeah, but EPI didn't need to do a study for me on that. Look, I spent 20 I spent 20 years in the trucking industry, and every bad idea starts itself in the trucking industry. You know, they did this independent contractor model 20 years ago where, you know, they told the guy, hey, you know, you lease this truck, you'll work for half of the going rate. You'll pay the, you know, all the insurance and all the taxes and the tolls and all this stuff. And you'll make, you know, a small amount of money. But at the end of 7 years, the truck will be yours. And without telling them that in 7 years, the truck will have well more than a million miles on it. It'll be basically junk. But you know, never mind that. You're your own boss. And, you know, I saw guys, you know, I could tell you horror stories, but the one guy sticks out in my mind. He said he was home 5 days the 1 year and brought home $16,000.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it is something, and that's a good point, that this has been going on throughout our economy for people who are classified as employees. So, you know, yes, the deck is stacked against a lot of these independent contractors in the gig economy. But is it all that much different than a fast food worker or a retailer worker who has to contend with just-in-time scheduling, where they never know even if they're scheduled for their shift and they figure out how to do childcare and they get in, they might say business might be slow and they might have to go home after an hour. So it really comes down to an analysis of not just protections but power, because if we don't have power for workers in our economy, it's continually going to be a whack-a-mole game.
Yeah. No, I remember my first job in high school. You know, the first time I was confronted with that same thing. So we're going to put you on the schedule and you have to be here, but you might not work. And I told my grandfather this because I was living with my grandparents at the time, and he said, "No, you're not." He goes, "You're not doing that," because he was a union guy. He goes, "You're not doing that." He goes, call him back, tell him, never mind, thanks anyway. And, you know, he said, you're not going to put yourself through that. He goes, you know, we didn't fight to organize and to build a middle class so that you can be taken advantage of. And I still remember that lesson. And I wonder why people put up with it, other than I know people are desperate. And this is what happens when you have a desperation class in our economy.
Yeah. And I think that sometimes you have to be very to think about, you know, a lot of times, when you get into the conversations about logistics or, you know, transportation network companies like Uber and Gig or Uber and Lyft, people say, well, you know, we're going to have automation come and then there will be no jobs. And automation doesn't have to be about getting rid of jobs. It can be supplementing jobs. It can be creating new jobs. There's a lot that can happen from automation. We don't really know what the case will be, but it should never be used as an excuse to drive down standards now.
No, you're absolutely right. But you're right. They're using it as a bludgeon. Now, I happen to be one of the people who are kind of fearful of what happens when automation takes over. I fully expect the trucking industry, and I keep telling my truck driver friends, you know, in 15 years, don't plan on there being any long-haul truck driving jobs left. There'll still be the P&D and local stuff, but I don't expect, you know, because you've got the technology now to put a truck on the road, you know, on the turnpike and run it all the way across the state without stopping. And I see those jobs going away, you know, relatively quickly when the technology gets better. And I don't know what you do with all of those people whose their livelihood is doing that. I don't know that you can train them to make $80,000 a year doing anything else. So I'm a little afraid of that. And I'm sure you're going to tell me why I shouldn't be, but I am. I'm a little weirded out by it.
I was just talking to somebody about automation of trucking the other day, and they said basically you'd have to just to automate a rig that isn't ready for the road today, but you know, as we best could, you would be adding another 33% to the cost of the vehicle. That's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to be the sort of thing that companies keep jumping to invest until prices go down, and then you also have to go through the hoops of you know, municipal regulation, state regulation, and national regulation. So I do think that this, I think it's coming. I'm not saying it's not coming. I don't think it's coming. You know, sometimes you hear it's coming in 5 years. I don't think it's coming in 5 years.
I say 15.
But that said, there will definitely be industries that fade away, new industries that come.
Certainly.
And so my question is, like, what are we doing to make sure that those new industries are good, and how are we giving workers both a slice of the pie as automation in their industry makes things more valuable? Is there a way that they can share in that wealth, you know, through ownership, profit sharing plans, and so on? And how do they negotiate themselves into, no, there won't be as many jobs, but how do you negotiate yourself into the logistics, into those logistics roles that those truck drivers who have lots of experience and know the industry backwards and forward, so that they're the ones taking over in those positions and they're negotiating over training to can be able to do that?
No, I'm right there with you on all of that.
It's everyone's problem, so that's why we need growth.
Look,
the industry is also a good one.
No, I'm not a Luddite by any stretch of the imagination. You know, progress is going to move us forward, because guess what? We're not stopping it. It's going to happen whether we're against it or not. So I'm in favor of how do we move forward, but how do we make sure that people benefit from it, instead of having what we've been seeing is that we get the Mark Zuckerbergs and the handful that, you know, make a huge, enormous amounts of money. And then all the people, all the worker bees who are, well, the gig economy, who aren't making it to the end of the week, let alone the end of the month.
No, I mean, it's too hard for two Americans right now. And that's not something that was part of the definition of the American dream, where you work as hard as you possibly can, and there's no promise you'll get ahead, and your children will probably do worse. So we've got to figure out how we build that back. It takes raising the minimum wage. It takes thinking about how you get workers more protections on the job. You think about protections for independent contractors, but also giving them a job as well.
Yeah, there you go. Good points, all in the all of that. Last question: what should we be paying attention to? Out of this report, does this go anywhere? Or is just it's another one of those reports that you guys in D.C. looked at and shuffled through the papers, and we're on to the next thing. What do we take out of this?
So there's more information coming. This was the first cut of data that was the most high level. There's going to be a couple more questions. That are looking at gig economy specifically. I think that'll be interesting. The other place where there's good data coming is actually the Treasury that's able to look at tax returns. They're able to get a better, more accurate picture of not just workers who are doing, this gig work full time, but those who are doing it part time. And they know that workers aren't getting, it's the actual way they're getting paid that they're looking at. So there's not confusion, and there's not the problem. Classification, adding another layer of problems with the data.
Right, more things to be looking at, and another opportunity for you to come back and share your wit and your information and all of that, and keep us up to date.
Thanks so much.
Good stuff. Great talking to you, Carla. I appreciate the time. Carla Walter, director of the employment policy there at the Center for American Progress. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
From UN headquarters in New York, I'm Luke Vargas with your World in 2 Minutes. The goal of the X Prize is to use sponsorship money and a prize system to address market failures and spur innovation in key areas, from oil cleanup to creating water from thin air. Not all X Prizes are claimed, but on Wednesday, one of them was, the Anu and Naveen Jain Women's Safety X Prize. The $1 million challenge was to build a device that triggered an inconspicuous emergency alert if a woman is threatened or attacked, and it has to work if a woman's cell phone is snatched.
People want a solution that should be independent of the smartphone and should have audio and other stuff recording features.
That's Avinash Bansal, the operations director for Leaf Wearables, the Indian team that won the X Prize. Their device, called the Safer Pro, is a small chip that can be installed into a smartwatch or onto less noticeable pieces of jewelry. When an alert is triggered, a message and location details are sent to pre-selected guardians over Bluetooth or through a mesh network of other devices. And to boot, explains Neymarika Rajiv, an advisor to the winning team, their product is affordable at less than $40.
This product works as well as in developing countries as it would in a country like America. It is something that at a price point which is, you know, absolutely workable for everyone.
A new Gallup poll released on Thursday asked people in 142 countries how safe they felt walking alone at night, and the results show the importance of women's safety devices. While more than 90% of those in Singapore or Norway felt safe walking alone, those numbers plummeted in Argentina and Mexico at 40%, or in Brazil and South Africa at 31%, and that includes answers from men. Leaf Wearables co-founder Manik Mehta.
If my device is with one person, you know, and that person gets saved, it helps me sleep better.
Luke Vargas, the United Nations.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Thinking about Carla's comment about the non-compete clauses. Yeah, I remember when that was all going on. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you know, a couple of years back, the sandwich shop, Jimmy John's, wanted all of their employees to sign non-compete agreements, which are, you know, if you work for us, you can't go work for Subway or McDonald's or anywhere where they have sandwiches. Because evidently their sandwich was proprietary information, and you know, putting meat between two pieces of bun was a highly skilled, highly trained position, and that you weren't allowed to go do it. Evidently, they had a series of condiments that used to go on that, you know, was special to them, which is all ludicrous. But what it was, and Carlo is completely accurate. It's not legal. I mean, it doesn't hold any water, but it's that chilling effect. It's that, you know, you're talking about a minimum wage worker, mostly, you know, like a high school kid, you know, maybe someone in their 20s or maybe someone who, you know, look, life has been difficult for them. It's the best job they can get. And, you know, this idea that you can now scare them into not seeking another job for, you know, a nickel an hour more or 10 cents, you know, has this chilling effect on people moving around. And I remember at the time, you know, we had a couple of Jimmy John workers on the show, you know, back, you know, several years back. And, you know, they were all saying, yeah, we thought it was enforceable. You know, why would the employer do it if it wasn't legal? And you hear this all the time. You know, my head was about to explode. And if, you know, if you've been listening to me for, you know, any longer than 2 days, you know, I think a lot of our problems are solved by having unions. By having, you know, an organized workforce to where you have a lawyer in the mix somewhere to go, you know what, that's not legal. To sit down and actually negotiate employment contracts to make sure that that stuff doesn't happen. And, you know, I remember at the time, you know, talking to these kids and these you know, these adult workers and going, you know, did you not know this? Because I'll be honest, I struggle. And maybe it's just that I was fortunate and that my grandfather was, you know, was a union guy and you kind of instilled that kind of thinking in me. And maybe it was just, you know, I've always had a union job, so it just seems like the natural thing to do. But, you know, I'm often shocked and amazed at how we as a working class in this country, in a first world country, a highly educated country, a country with lots of, evidently too many laws and protections and job-killing regulations, that we wouldn't know that some of this stuff is just flat ludicrous. And then to say, you know what, even if it is legal and ludicrous, to say, no, we want to change it. I mean, there are days where I sometimes marvel in talking with some people that I work with about their views on what labor does, what unions do, and why we need them. You know, I work part-time at a place that, you know, everybody complains about how horrible the healthcare is. And, you know, I say, well, the first thing you should probably do is, oh, I don't know, organize, demand better, collectively come together and demand better. And it's, you know, it's you literally see the look on their face of confusion. Like, what is he talking about? And you know, this is where I tell my union friends, you've got a lot of educating to do. You've got a lot of outreach to do. You've got a lot of talking to people to do. Because you know, you look at what's happened in this country, especially to the working class, and even the educated class. Look, I mean, you look at the number of graduate assistant students who are organizing to get, you know, at least some reasonable pay for their labor as graduate assistants. And you look at, you know, even, you know, the tech workers are going, you know, finally, we got to do something. And these gig economy people, you know, one of the big fastest growing sectors of unionization in this country right now is all these digital platforms with all these journalists who had always been freelance or independent contractors now being brought in and now organizing and saying, you know what, we may still all be independent contractors and freelancers, but we're not going to do work for you unless we get this. And maybe that's the future. Maybe, as Carlo, you know, alluded to, maybe the Uber drivers and these independent contractors, you know, coming together in associations, maybe that's the future. Worker centers, I don't know. But at some point, you have to imagine that while we're told 3.8% unemployment is, you know, historically low, there's still people who are struggling to make it to tomorrow. And it's my view and it's my hope. At some point, we go, enough's enough. We need to restore reward to work. We need to restore that American dream of, if I work hard, I play by the rules, that I actually get ahead and my kids get ahead and they do better than I did. Just kind of my thought. I'd love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think. If I said something that got under your skin, love to hear those the most, especially the ones that start off with, you're an idiot. Love those. Quick break. Right back.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.